Joseph.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here. Thanks for joining me. Seriously, thanks for giving me the time, spending some time with me on a weekly basis when we talk about money and sometimes politics, investments. We talk about economics. We talk about the world. And it's a great way, I think, to really understand some of the things that are going on out there from a variety of different guests. Speaking of which, we have a great individual on today. Someone who's been involved in the banking business for many, many years with Merrill Lynch on the credit teams, understands derivatives, has a book out that you have to pick up. We'll talk about that when we get him on. His name is Satyajit Das. We call him Das because first name's not the easiest to pronounce, but for us Westerners, I guess. But Das is a great guy and really just a real wealth of knowledge, and I can't wait to bring him on and talk about some of the things going on. His papers that he writes are just amazing. On the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, I have listed a good amount of the place where you can find his work, his writings, his information, and get a copy of his book as well. I think that that's something that you'd want to pay attention to. I have a few things we're going to talk about a little bit on the outskirts of investing today. There was something that kind of crossed my desk that I've been watching for some time, and not all the time do we always look at just, you know, stocks or ETFs or bonds and things like that. Sometimes, you know, you have these alternative investments that come around that may be of interest. And I'm going to talk to you about that just kind of briefly. And then I'll get some more information. We'll talk about it maybe next week. But I also want to mention that, you know, we have a sponsor, GoToMyPC. And, you know, this let me just kind of tell you that clearly we know that, you know, the problems we have, like everything we need is on our computers all the time. And maybe we have to go work in another location. You have to copy files on a flash drive or email documents to yourself. It's a real hassle. So what do you do? Well, I use GoToMyPC to remotely access a computer, my computers, from any other computer out there. All you need is an internet connection. Use any program, work on any file, check emails, and access the network resources. It's really easy to set up and use. Great sponsor of ours, and I really appreciate if you would check them out. You can go to the address I'm going to tell you in a second and get a free 30 days. You can try GoToMyPC free for 30 days. That's a month of unlimited remote access for free. And for this special offer, you must go to www.gotomypc.com/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast for a free trial. All right, so we got that done. I think that's a great service, and I want to thank GoToMyPC for being a great sponsor all this time. I want to talk about the economic data first that just came out over the last week or so. Very disappointing. I think we all agree that the employment numbers from ADP and from the BLS were kind of disappointing. The overall joblessness, if you will, is approaching 17% or so right now. We have a 9.8 on the official BLS number for the unemployment rate. We saw north of 250 on the non-farm payrolls on Friday. Manufacturing numbers came out kind of disappointing as well. There was a couple of things that were good in the beginning of the week. We saw some consumer confidence numbers that came in good. But then the Chicago PMI, the ISM manufacturing, factory production, and factory orders came in very, very disappointing. We also saw that in Japan, the Tonkin survey that comes out, this is a survey of businesses and what their expectations are and what they'll be ordering, kind of like a combination of manufacturing and factory orders, et cetera. And this comes out as a good read on what they expect to be spending money on over the next 12 months, let's say. Very disappointing there as well, and that really kind of put Japan into a tailspin on top of the fact that, you know, they're continuing to see deflationary pressures, dramatic deflationary pressures. And the yen has been rising. The yen has been rising. The dollar has been ticking up. And that's a sign that risk appetite in the world of currencies is not what it, you know, what it has been. The dollar has been on just a dramatic slide for the last few months as risk appetite has increased and carry trades have been increasing as well in the area of looking at, we talked about this with Art Cashin a bit last week, that where you can borrow money very cheaply in the U.S. and the U.S. you can sell the dollar and buy other currencies like the New Zealand or Australia, and you get a great return on that. But when you see this dramatic move, this 1% move or a 0.5% move up on the dollar, that really kind of throws things out of whack because a lot of leverage can be used in that area. So the dollar moving up, there has been at least a direct correlation with the dollar moving up, the yen moving up, and the stock markets of those countries. Of course, the stock market of the U.S., Japan, to a lesser degree, sometimes China, affects the rest of the world. And as we've seen time and time again, the entire world move up since March. You know, we see this kind of rotation. You see China move up, and you see Europe move up, and the U.S. moves up. Maybe the U.S. moves down a little bit, then China moves down, then Europe moves down. You get into this kind of feedback loop. Have you noticed that? Get into this kind of world where everything seems to be just doing the same thing over and over, you know, on its own. You know, you get moving up, moving up, moving up, moving down, moving down, moving down. That's what happened. I mean, Asia is at about a 2-month low right now on some of those markets. Brazil has been just incredible. You know, there are the BRIC countries, if you're not familiar with them, BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. We like to call and we like to invest in the BIC companies, BIC. We don't like to invest in Russia, even though the markets over there have been just on a tear this year. Any market, in my opinion, that closes for a couple of days because there's imbalances in the trading and they're afraid they're just going to crash the market is not an area we want to invest in. Any market that is so reliant on oil and some of the commodities, even though Brazil is not an area we want to invest in. Any market that has, you know, the oversight like they have and questions, it's just not necessary. Yeah, you can make a lot of money there, but you could lose a ton as well. They were down, 80% from top to bottom a year ago. India, China, Brazil, some of the youngest populations out there besides Singapore, South Korea. And these are areas that are just really great opportunities. They are building the infrastructures to be much more self-reliant. We like Hong Kong versus China. China, again, was sliding lately. And we'll see what happens next week. There's an elongated holiday for many of the Asian countries that's going to keep them out of any kind of movement over the next, I don't know, few days, I guess, looking backwards. I think they reopen Monday. It's about 4 or 5 days for some of them. And that can be, especially for China. I think it may only be China, actually. But nonetheless, Asia has been hit pretty hard with the fact that the yen has been, well, Japan, first of all, let me back up. Japan has been hit hard when the yen keeps rising, hurting their exports dramatically. Car sales have been, you know, sliding after the cash for clunkers. We saw that number come out, a 23% overall reduction in year-over-year sales of cars, plunging on GM 45% or so. We wrote a post on that. The Disciplined Investor gives you all the data and all the information about what's going on. But, you know, where's the revival? How much of the cash for clunkers pulled future sales out of the forward couple of months, right? So that's a big issue that's really pending right now. But the economics right now, going into almost the same look as we saw in the end of June into July before we saw the next layer of earnings reports, which are coming out soon. And by the way, the official, quote-unquote, official earnings season starts with the kickoff of Alcoa. Alcoa is the symbolic start of the traditional earnings season, and that's coming up shortly. Question is, what's going to happen? Here's a couple of theories for you. All right, so first we have this idea that we'll talk about inventory rebuilds. And inventory rebuilds were all about this whole idea that inventories were really short. You know, customers were not buying, and manufacturing didn't need to be done. And on top of that, what we had and what we saw was that many of the stores just said, you know what, we're not going to be needing anything right now. We need to keep our inventories down. We need to cut employees. We know all about this. And that's how the magical moment came over the last couple of quarters where they were beating EPS, but yet we saw time and time again revenue being short. The revenue shortfalls were kind of dismissed because companies were able to beat the estimates, the lowball estimates of EPS. And now what's happening is, that happened for two quarters, and now what's happening is the question is raised, if growth comes back, if and when growth comes back, how much of an inventory rebuild will have to happen, number one? And number two, how much employment is going to have to return to the markets? Well, we haven't seen the employment return yet, meaning the stores are still not looking to, or when I say stores, I'm talking about just generally not only retail, but just across the board, manufacturer stores, et cetera, are not rehiring yet. A couple of reasons for that. Technology has done a great job. We talk about this, and this is in our last economic commentary. We call this a bit of a consumption cannibalism. Consumption cannibalism. Think about that. When you have a factory or a manufacturing facility or sales force, whatever it is, and somehow technology can take over for a human being, well, that's great because it may make it more efficient, potentially. It may make it much more cost-effective. That's clear. But the difference is that while you don't have to pay bonuses, overtime, and benefits of any sort to the machine or the technology, they're also not consuming any food. They're not buying clothes. They're not taking a ride and going on vacation. And all those things that aren't happening are not being put back into the economy. So while you become a lean, green money machine as a company, what happens is that who's going to be buying your product? If you're cannibalizing on the consumption part of it, this giant cycle stays for a while. How long? I don't know. Maybe can it be offset by, you know, hopefully China is going to be buying our things. I don't think so. You know, they have enough production going on there right now. But maybe they'll buy some things, of course, and services, et cetera. But we've also turned into a much more service-oriented, you know, country. But moving beyond that, the inventory restocking cycle, we've seen some of that, but inventories are still very, very low. You add that to the fact that hiring is still at a low point. I don't know if we're actually in that cycle or that part of the cycle yet. As companies start to rehire, do we say, wait a minute, their earnings are going to be affected dramatically as compared to what they were? As analysts are getting much more positive, because they usually do this late and early, they get much more positive on what's going to be happening for earnings moving forward, are we going to see disappointments? Are we going to see revenues ramping up? Are they going to still fall short? And I got to tell you something. You take a look at what RIM Research in Motion recently did. You look at like a company like Copart. You know, when you come in a little bit short on revenue these days and short on the EPS number, it is an ugly, ugly set of circumstances for the stock moving forward. So what do we see moving forward? Well, clearly the employment situation is getting better. Clearly the comparative numbers on a year-over-year basis are looking better. When we look at things like manufacturing and PMI, and we look at, you know, all the different statistics on the economics, or many of the different statistics, but we're still seeing this hesitancy because there really isn't the demand that has returned as of yet, and you wouldn't expect that with the kind of unemployment rate that we have now. Even though we hear them say all the time that unemployment is a lagging indicator, it is still a coincident indicator showing us what's happening in the economy, particularly on Thursdays when we look at the initial claims numbers. Now, Congress is going to be looking at potentially expanding another 13 weeks or so for the unemployment benefits because so many people are falling off the unemployment benefit rolls. That's why we're seeing the continuing claims kind of come down a little bit. It's not that there's people just not on there and people going back to work right now, it seems. It's because people are falling off and not having the income, and Congress doesn't want to have not only unemployment, but people without money. So that's why we saw the retail stocks a couple of weeks ago when this news came out kind of get a nice pop, some of them at least. But at the same time, we have to wonder, and we have to think for a second, while economics are important, and while sometimes they are ignored, usually what happens is things catch up. Does that mean we're in for an all-out crash? I mean, the last 2 weeks have been just ugly, right? Upwards of about a 6% loss. The good news is that we hedged out most of that for our clients. Matter of fact, I think the overall markets of the last 2 weeks on the S&P 500 was down somewhere in the neighborhood of, where was that? About 6%. Was that right? No, about 3.5%, 4%. Well, top to bottom. But let's just talk about the weekly. So the last 2 weeks, the S&P is down 4.5% or so. And we actually didn't get hit at all because we, right before that, hedged out utilizing a couple of ETFs. We took a big position in SH. We're short. I'll give you some of our shorts here. Short Potash. We shorted AutoZone on before the earnings came out, and that worked out very nicely. Also short Wells Fargo. And we added Fiserv recently and also added a very significant position of the short Russell 2000s. Now, these things are, when you look at the shorts, you got to be very careful these days, especially in the hedges. The two ETFs we talk about were hedged out on. But, you know, that's how we hedge it out. You got to be careful because you're not going to get the upside if the markets start moving away from you if you have long positions. You know, right now the market is still in a bullish mode and we will stay long but hedge out and find the stocks that we find won't do well, particularly if the dollar moves down. We did, by the way, check this out, EUO. It's a position that's a double short euro. So we're looking at the dollar moving up against the euro. European stocks, European markets, European currencies still have a lot of problems out there. And we think that if there is a flight to safety, it will be to the dollar. And the dollar is beaten down so much right now, even with the quantitative easing that we're seeing and the outright destruction by the Fed and the Treasury on the dollar, we still think that we're at a little bit of a bounce point right here. So kind of looking forward, I think that we need to see how, you know, not jumping in with both feet into the next quarter's earnings, because I think that we need to test the water a little bit. Alcoa will be interesting, but it's a materials play, and that could be questionable. There's a lot of currency and question about car manufacturing and housing, et cetera, in that area with Alcoa. Although they, in their last, if you remember, in their last numbers that they put out, they showed that that they had a 75% reduction in overall employees that are going to be permanent, as a permanent reduction. I don't know how they operate if, in fact, growth ramps up, but that's what they're saying. And I think that we have to be very careful and be very careful when you get in and kind of inch in. What we like to do is, for example, with the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, what we do is often take an initial position of 1.5%. And depending on the conviction we have, we add to that as it breaks above or at our points of new buy points. So the conviction moves up. And then you set your stop points on either what we call bounce points, support levels. You look at moving averages, et cetera, and you work with those to find out, you know, where you are willing to take the stock down. So our clients don't get hit by any individual stocks that or broad-based positions that move against you dramatically. You could always get back in. These days it's cheap enough to do so, right? Anyway, I also want to talk about something else that's kind of off the beaten path. You may be interested in this, but just check this out. I want you to put your thinking caps on for a second here. You know, a lot of things over the last year have changed. And one of the things that has happened is that there are programs, for example, that if you remember the viatical world, which is kind of corrupt and all sorts of problems with that. But if you remember what happened with that, hedge funds really got involved in that. That was buying life insurance policies on aging individuals. It kind of got out of hand. It got pretty crazy, as a matter of fact. But those were only available oftentimes in bulk and great pricing and all that to these hedge funds. So what happened was that they kind of consumed it, and then they kind of eventually came down to the consumer, et cetera. Well, there's something else going on in this recession. There are a lot of people who have, for example, structured settlements, and they have the benefits of an income from a stream from an annuity or something like that. And what's happened is that they need more money. In other words, so they have this stream of income coming in, $2,000 a month for the rest of their life, let's say. And they need more money. They need $20,000. They need $50,000. They can't live on this anymore. They need a lot more money to fix the roof or whatever. And they're actually selling the stream. So what happens is you can actually go and through a court order, you can go and buy, and through this arrangement, you could buy the actual stream of income, usually as a discount, which is kind of cool, from them. So let's say the stream of income, when you calculate it out, is for $2,000 for the rest of their life, comes out to be $100,000 or something like that. Well, maybe they're offered $80,000 and the $20,000 differential that you keep. So you pay the $80,000 and you get this stream of income, which could be a 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12% income stream to the buyer. And what happened was that these weren't available for a while, because really, before the recession, there was no need for it as much. But now all of a sudden people, like, they sell their gold, but they're selling their income payments, their income streams. And I've looked at this before, and they weren't as good because when interest rates were high. But now that interest rates are so low, I mean, who wouldn't get, you know, it's guaranteed. It's guaranteed by the insurance company. You get a direct assignment on this. So a lot of times we use these alternative investments to kind of pepper a portfolio. And I thought that I met with a gentleman who I've known for many years, and he does these kind of things. And I said, you know what? I bet you there's so many people right now that would love, so many people that are out of the markets right now, even though, you know, we think there's a great opportunity in both sides of the market. But, you know, how many people wouldn't like a 7%, 8% guarantee, right? So I thought, anyway, we'll talk more about this next week. I'll give you some of the details. But what I want to do was, if you want the information, we'll put a little link on the show notes on this. It's, you know, there's so many of these available right now, but they go quickly, because what happens is they're being, you know, people want income. They need guarantees. When you're guaranteed by a Metropolitan Life, you're guaranteed by a Mass Mutual, you're guaranteed by a whoever else is out there that did this, when you get the direct assignment and guarantee, and then you pay the money, and then you get this great stream of income, or you take out one of these deals where you don't have to actually do that. You could actually have almost like a zero coupon, I guess it is. I guess the best way to describe it. You have a zero coupon, cool stuff. Anyway, so these deals where it's, you know, the guaranteed income through annuities, GIAs they call them. Anyway, we'll put a link on that if you're interested in that. I'll get this guy to send you out some of the information on. I thought it was really cool. And we'll talk about it more next week, because I want to kind of explore some of this and do some further research. But if you are interested, I saw some things in the 8% range recently. So anyway, with that, I want to get into this conversation with Das, who I have some questions for him about, you know, what is actually going on in the banking area, what's going on with the toxic assets. Are you wondering about that? What's going on with the PPIP? I mean, it's kind of like it just disappeared off the face of the earth, this discussion. So anyway, we'll talk to him. He also has this thought about that I've read a lot of his work, that we're kind of in the point where where Japan was for some time, where they kept interest rates low like this for an elongated period. There's been some discussion that they're going to move up quickly, but I don't know. I don't know if that's going to be in the cards right now, the way these guys are talking, and the Fed and the Treasury, you know, we need to keep it low to spur on the housing, which, again, is not spurring. So anyway, we get back, we'll talk with Das, and then we'll wrap it up. Thanks for listening to Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll be right back after a couple of seconds of a musical interlude. Hang on, we'll be right back. As we talked about last week, I have a specialist in the banking industry, someone who knows the ins and outs of the banks, the financial industry. He has over 30 years of experience. He's worked in the derivative areas before it was actually called derivatives. His name is Satyajit Das. We call him Das. And he's from down under, actually calling in Australia. How are you, Das?
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So let's talk a little bit about, we know you've worked for over 30 years. You've been on a treasurer of a company that deals with, obviously, the finer details of balance sheets and cash flow statements. And you've written just a ton. As a matter of fact, I think I told you, I was reading Bloomberg magazine 2 weeks ago, and I wrote you. I said, is that you? Yeah, that was you. You're talking about what's going on with some of the new rules and some of the things that are happening within the banking industry. And I have so many of your pieces in front of me. Voodoo Banking, The Outlook for Banks, Global Financial System, Calling for the Plumber, Catastrophic to Awful, The Banking Spin Cycle. Where are we now in the whole world of banking? Particularly, let's start with the U.S., because we have a lot of, you know, mostly U.S. listeners. But are things better as they seem to be being told to us?
I think fundamentally you've got to look at two phases. I think last year, essentially, the banking system was close to collapse. And so people got very, very negative. And then subsequently, the massive, massive intervention from the Federal Reserve and the Treasury has obviously propped up the banking system. Mm-hmm. But essentially, I always use the analogy that at the end of the Soviet Union, when Leonid Brezhnev was the General Party Secretary, he was probably dead for many, many months before his death was actually acknowledged.
Right.
So I think the banking system is a bit like that. It's being propped up by artificial means. And I think you have to go back to a really, really fundamental thing. What we've seen is losses. And banks are highly leveraged institutions, and of course, over the last 20 years, they got very leveraged. And under those circumstances, they've wiped out a lot of their capital. And they replaced some of it, to be very, very fair, but they wiped out a lot of it. And the fundamental thing going forward is going to be how they replace the capital. And also, a key thing is banks make most of their money from lending money.
Mm-hmm.
And the real thing is, what is going to be the appetite for debt to actually find customers for, I suppose, their drugs, which is debt. And
right.
We'll have to wait and see what happens on that front.
It seems like there's an incredible turn over the last 6 months, and an appetite has returned for high-yield debt in particular, and it's almost like a voracious appetite for all the credit issuing that's going on, the secondaries that are going on, whether it's from banks or not. We haven't seen as much from banks lately, but it is kind of amazing, I think, how fast the appetite has returned for many things these days, almost after, what, four or five months, when everybody didn't want to even talk about it anymore.
Well, I think you've got to separate the activity in capital markets into a few little niches. The first was the banks certainly have issued a lot of debt. And the reason they've done it is primarily, as you know, banks always borrow short, lend long. And obviously the liquidity scare they got when they literally couldn't borrow money into bank or actually borrow money from anybody, really.
Mm-hmm.
They panicked, and the FDIC guarantee in the United States and the government guarantees pretty much uniformly around the developed world have allowed them to borrow. And they've used that window to bang out a huge, huge amount of debt. And so what that's done is bloated the activity. And if you actually strip that out, the issuance levels are obviously still healthy, but they're obviously not as healthy as they might seem otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
The second niche is really the banks have pretty much stopped lending. So they still have customers. They still have customers who want to borrow, and particularly they want to wean them off bank lines. So what they've been doing, particularly for high-grade corporates, switching them into the capital markets, because the actual demand for high-yield debt, investment high-grade debt,
mm-hmm.
has been very, very strong because
right.
people just want to switch out of banks. And to some extent, they're also switching out of sovereigns to some lesser degree simply because they're concerned about these fiscal deficits. And the last element is probably the most puzzling of the lot of them because essentially we've seen, as you correctly point out, a huge, huge flow into not only corporate bonds but non-investment grade or
right.
high-yield or
yeah.
junk bonds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that, I think, is fundamentally a chasing of yield. That's fundamentally chasing yield. Because essentially, if you're a retired person with money market funds paying 11 basis points, you know, you can't buy your weenies or your hot dogs on 11 basis points. So basically, you're going to have to do something.
Right.
And some of that money has gone into high yield. But that's a very dangerous game at this part of the cycle, simply because I can't actually reconcile three almost completely discordant facts. One is money is flowing into the high-yield funds.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the actual rally, which we saw from November to now, November 2008 to now, is fairly mature because, you know, if you bought double B and single B bonds, you would have made anywhere between 40 and 75%.
Yeah.
And they're chasing yesterday's returns, which
right.
is always dangerous. And the last thing is corporate defaults, particularly in the high-yield space, are continuing to rise because of the weak economy. So it's completely sort of like a case of cognitive dissonance and people chasing yesterday's returns. It's a very dangerous phase of the market.
I remember something like this happening back in the 80s this has happened when interest rates were very low, but CMOs at the time, if you remember that, were higher. Merrill Lynch was issuing all these, and those kind of blew up in everybody's faces. But a lot of the seniors out there were chasing yields, and they just got taken out left and right. It was really kind of a very difficult time because what was happening was they already lost money, so they were looking for alternatives. They looked for alternatives that had a higher yield because they had to make back the income stream that they needed because they had less principal. So they pushed it into something with a higher yield, but yet not really even thinking about the fact that it was that much more risky for them.
Well, I think essentially you're absolutely correct. In fact, I used to work at Merrill Lynch in those days.
So oh, you know what
unusual.
I'm talking about.
I do know what you're talking about. And I remember the financial consultants in Merrill Lynch just coming and screaming at us, basically saying, you know, you got to give me some yield. These guys are dying out there, so they want some yield. And we're saying, well, you know, they have to take some risk. And I think it's a very, very dangerous part of the cycle to
yeah.
be taking more and more risk. I think, as I am on record as saying, is at the end of last year, I thought the overwhelming buy was not necessarily equities, but it was certainly corporate credit, because everybody was assuming roughly about half the world's companies would default,
mm-hmm.
which clearly is unreasonable.
Right.
And you had people like GE, which is obviously not non-investment grade, it's a very high-grade corporate, trading at 11, 12%, you know, even to maturity. And as I said to somebody at the time, I remember quite distinctly, is that if GE goes under, we don't have a financial system to worry about.
Right.
So probably if you're going to, you know, bet the house, that's probably the one bet that you should make. And mm-hmm. that has obviously paid off pretty well. But that cycle, I think, is coming to an end, or has already ended.
Well, not to mention the fact that we also have the, you know, ridiculously low interest rates that are, you know, admittedly going to stay low for a while because as the economics force which is kind of silly, actually, because if they're not lending, what's the difference what their interest rate is? But that's a different discussion. I mean,
that's very true, but it's actually interesting to talk about the low interest rates because, as you know, the Federal Reserve Vice Chairman Kahn came out and basically confirmed that interest rates are going to stay for a long time. And it was eerily reminiscent of discussions that I remember in the 1990s in Japan when they initially started to say that, you know, this was only temporary. Then it became, well, it'll be for a little bit. And then they said, well, it'll be as for long as it needs. And there's a hidden agenda here which nobody talks about. The Fed is using low interest rates to recapitalize the bank.
No, of course. It's a back door.
Absolutely.
It's going in the back door, like the FDIC. If I may interrupt you, this is what I was thinking this
sure.
week. Sheila Bair talks about how that they need $50 billion. They don't want to ask the Treasury. They're out of money. You know, there's a lot more banks going to fail. And they need $50 billion. So they're going to go to the banks, and they're going to – there was a lot of different things, borrow from the banks, et cetera. Now they're going to do a three-year acceleration potentially – of the fees that the largest and strongest banks will have to pay to the FDIC to essentially recapitalize the FDIC fund and then pass it out where it needs to be. But what's interesting about that is that really so bad? Well, it's bad, but if interest rates stay as low as they are, technically it comes in almost free to them.
Absolutely correct.
Right?
You're absolutely correct. And I always joke that that's the first lesson of Japan 101, of Japan Central Banking 101. That's how they recapitalize the banks. And as you correctly point out, it's politically more palatable because you don't have to go to Congress and the Senate.
And you don't see it. You don't see it.
Yeah, they don't see it. And that's a massive subsidy. And people have to realize there's a massive transfer of wealth going on from savers to the banking system as a result of that.
That's really sad. It really is. It's very disturbing. It really is very disturbing. Yes, it has to be done, and I understand that, but the reality is that it's very disturbing, the risks that were taken, the risks that are being taken, because there's still a lot of new deals being securitized. Again, they say securitization is dead and all that. Now, they're just packaging it differently. You know, they're selling the crap off in a different wrapper and still coming up with all sorts of things. The newest loan deals are tied to the profitability of companies. Have you seen this? You know, a company can get a loan, but yet it's going to be – I mean, what happens if the profitability goes down? They have to pay more. If they have to pay more when the profitability is down, that's going to take the company out.
Oh, I think it's absolutely correct. We're seeing some of the most toxic types of structures. But also what is fascinating is if you actually look at the period that led up to the global financial crisis, which is around 2005, 2006, I was quite active in particularly leverage loans because a lot of private equity was being done. And I actually said to somebody at the time, is there any buyer out there other than these CLO and CDO funds? And I said, what do you mean? I said, well, is there anybody genuinely who actually has money buying this stuff? And we have the same now, except it's the Fed. Yeah. As I said, the Fed's got to be the most gigantic CDO in the world.
It really is amazing. And then we keep on giving money out to all sorts of different places. Let me ask you a question about the toxic assets. I think the PPIP, again, in the U.S., I mean, you know, the PPIP it raised, I think, $3.4 billion. The toxic assets are still there around the world. But yet, there's no talk about them anymore. Are these things just going to go away somehow? I don't know how that is. I'm kind of saying that facetiously. But, you know, how do we get ourselves – well, let me say this. Are we any better with the toxic assets today than we were 6 months ago?
I don't think necessarily any of us know the answer clearly, but you have to look at it in a slightly different way. The first thing is what we've done is we've deferred the problem, which is we've changed the accounting rules. And the best way to describe the accounting rules is we've decided we favor gradual decay rather than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So we've pushed things into the future. The second thing is a lot of these assets are parked in, as you correctly point out, in the PPIP. But also, people forget that the central banks like the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of England, and even where I live in Australia, the central bank, has repoed a lot of these toxic assets. And they're sitting on their balance sheet. And, you know, I have this conversation with central bankers from time to time. I say, well, what are you going to do with this? They say, oh, it's only temporary. I said, well, what's temporary? And said, oh, it's just temporary. And I said, well, you're going to have to hold it until they liquidate from the underlying cash flows. And they go, no, we won't. Markets will improve. So I think fundamentally what they've done is defer the problem, and they're looking for improvements in terms of the actual economy. And so most of these mortgages, they're hoping, will pay back, or these toxic assets will pay back. And that's how they will liquidate that. But that's like a 10-year, 12-year time horizon that they're looking at. And what's also hidden the problem is there's been this sort of Ponzi rally in the financial market, mm-hmm. where the prices of these securities have recovered. I mean, leverage loans have gone from around about in the mid-50s to close to 90. And now somebody was trying to sell me some product the other day saying that it's the best performing asset class. I said, look, there's no trades, there's no reliable prices, you're just giving me these numbers, and I'm not saying they're wrong. But, you know, these are not real, because these are just markups by people. So under those circumstances, the problem is lying there. And I think the best way I'd say it, Andrew, is generally I find in life, if you want to fix a problem, you sort of fix the problem preparing for the recovery phase. In this case, what everybody is looking for is they're waiting for growth to solve the problems, which is a very, very dangerous sort of set of circumstances. Because if the growth doesn't come, and the economic circumstances don't improve fairly radically, then this problem will come back to haunt us. And there's a really fascinating, almost cultural issue. Nobody in the West wants to say that they're turning Japanese, but they are. Because I actually lived through the Japanese bubble melt, and this is exactly what happened. They just basically said, well, if you can park the asset long enough, you know, growth will take care of it. The only problem is, yeah. Growth never came.
Right. Well, the other thing is, what I really find really interesting, if they're backdooring money to the banks, and, you know, one of the things that happened is they said that their, you know, the share prices have gone up dramatically. Japan, as a matter of fact, recently took back a plan that they were going to, the government was going to input and start investing in public companies. Remember that? They recently.
Yes, I do.
Now, what does that mean? Because that was really troubling. I was thinking, wait a minute. They're going to start. Does that mean they're going to be active in the markets? And if that is the case, if they're going to be active in the markets, the public companies we're talking about, how do you buy public companies? You got to buy shares. If that is the case, are we seeing the invisible hand involved in these markets around the world? I mean, it almost looks like for a while China was, there was not ever letting it go down. And when things do go down, there's almost like an automatic braking system that's involved. Is that happening?
Well, I think fundamentally, I think Joseph Stiglitz once remarked that the invisible hand is called invisible because it's frequently not there. Mm. But I think in this case, we are now moving to a completely different paradigm of the economy, which is essentially we are going to have a lot of government interference, for better or for worse, to try to stabilize that. And I don't think necessarily that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think there's a certain element that was certainly necessary to, say, recapitalize the banks, because fundamentally the banking system collapses and people can't be sure of this security of their savings and their payments. Life becomes impossible. Mm-hmm. But now to try to stage a recovery by manipulating the bank prices is kind of more tricky in that sort of
mm-hmm.
sense.
Right.
But coming back to your point about the actual rally in bank prices, people still forget the bank prices, on average, are still substantially down from
right.
the peaks.
Right.
I mean, it's like saying that, you know, I keep saying to people, if something falls 50% and then goes up 50%, you're still down 25%
right.
from where you started the game.
Right.
And that's basically what we're seeing here.
Right.
And also, there is a numeraire effect, because if you think about it, the prices of some of these, like Citi, fell to such low levels, a $3 rise is a doubling of the bank price,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of crazy. So there's a lot of statistical effects, but the banks have also taken advantage, going back to your point about support. One of the most interesting things is if you look at the revenue line of the banks, and indeed, you know, everybody's now a bank, including Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, the critical thing is the underwriting of their risk by the central banks have led them to take on more risk,
right.
not less risk.
Right.
And if you look at their trading revenues, they've gone through the roof. In one way, the banks have been a beneficiary, if they've survived, of this underwriting of risk. And that's not a sustainable situation for the bank's profit and loss, but it's also a very dangerous situation for the economy at large when the central bank is underwriting all the risk in the system.
Well, here's what I say about that. And I want to talk to you about Citibank and Bank of America, and then we'll let you go. But I have a billion questions for you, actually. But when we saw the Goldman Sachs numbers last quarter, or the quarter before, and we saw, 90% of the days they were up or something like that, or maybe, 100, it was like 47 days out of the quarter, they were up $100 million in trading, and the rest of the time they were $50 million a day. And I scratched my head and I said, how do they do that? And I said to myself, the only way they do that, this is what I said, the only way they do that is if they know the outcome.
Well, I think you've got to be very, very careful with those numbers. You know, I used to set up systems to prepare those numbers, and there are a lot of problems in those numbers. One of the key things in that is whether you take out what we call agency business.
Mm-hmm.
See, one of the ways to actually fudge the numbers is you have in a bank generally the flow business, which is a client business.
Right.
And that client business has been incredibly profitable because, for instance, if you did a $100 million interest rate swap, say 3 years ago, around 2006,
mm-hmm.
for a good quality client, you'd be dealing on, say, a very, very tight bid offer spread of 1 basis point.
Mm-hmm.
That's now 10 basis points.
Mm.
And because of the volatility, people have been hedging and doing lots of things, or even unwinding hedges. So that part of the income, which is relatively low risk, can pad out your earnings.
Mm-hmm.
And I can show you at least 5 to 6 tricks of how you manipulate those figures. And so under those circumstances, it's not surprising that they showed such substantial amount of up days. Because if you commingle the agency revenue with what I would call the pure bets,
mm-hmm.
you actually effectively can show very, very stable revenues. And the whole trick is to show your investor base and the regulator, for that matter, that you have a very, very stable sort of trading outcome. And that's what you're doing. And I think there's a lot of conspiracy theories about why Goldman's make money so often. I think, to be very fair, their trading is generally good.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the agency income pads out a lot of that. And you see that also when you look at the big, big flow houses like J.P. Morgan and Deutsche and Barclays. They show exactly the same pattern. So it's got to be the mixing of those two incomes.
Right. So let's just really focus very quickly on some of the big boys, the too big to fail. That's the other part of the problem, obviously, the too big to fail. You know, if they trade, and if we just talk about trading only for a moment, and they fail, well, you know, Papa's back there to take care of them. You know, what is the story with the world banks? You know, the in London, we have some big problems over there, obviously. Eastern Europe is lurking with some default possibilities of a few countries, actually, right now. We have the U.S., we have the cities, we have the Bank of America, we have the Wells Fargo. I mean, we're seeing commercial loan issues that are really concerning and very, very large and looming. What is the, you know, situation truly with these banks?
Well, I think fundamentally the solvency risk has been taken out because the central bank, as you correctly point out, or the government will bail them out.
Mm-hmm.
However, the big, big issue going forward is going to be, do they have enough capital? Can they raise enough capital from the capital markets, or, if failing that, from the government, to actually continue to grow and make earnings? What we're seeing is two sources of earnings have to be split out. One is their core business, which is lending and normal activity.
Right,
that's shrinking. That's
mm-hmm.
down 30-40%.
Mm-hmm.
Their trading is supplementing that. But going forward, capital constraints and all sorts of other regulatory constraints are going to make it very, very difficult for them to return to the halcyon days of the past. And I think you've got to think about it at a really macro level. At one stage, I think the financial institutions group became something like 30-40% of the S&P 500 in terms of market cap.
Right, right, right.
And the in terms of effectively, I beg your pardon, it was around
23%. 20, I was going to say over 20.
20.
Right, right, right.
I was thinking the 40% was the earnings.
Right.
If you actually look at corporate earnings, mm-hmm. they came to 30-40%. That's clearly not possible because banking and financial institutions are a service industry. I mean, you can't have financial engineering as the only basis for an economy. Britain's finding that out at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to make some things and sell some things. So I think overall the outlook for banks is not necessarily good from the earnings point of view, but the solvency risk, which was such a major concern last year, has obviously gone away. But the other thing I would say is I'm absolutely amazed at the enthusiasm with which people are subscribing to these share issues by banks.
Yeah.
Because the one thing I do know, and I've learned over 30 years, is if a bank is in problems and is recapitalizing, you do not, and I repeat, do not want to actually give them money until you can be damn sure that it is the last round recapitalization.
Right.
Because
dilution.
Otherwise you're going to get diluted to
right.
death.
Right. But you know, what about this new FASB ruling? I mean, there's some FASB, first of all, the old FASB rulings, I don't know if they're ever going to catch up, but that was a big driver for earnings in the last couple of quarters. You know, where the mark-to-market was taken out, et cetera. What about this new FASB ruling where they're going to require a couple of different, or not ruling, I shouldn't say that, proposals. Proposal from FASB that, I don't know if you're probably familiar with it, but they're saying that, you know, that they want to have things back on the books, like securitized off-balance sheet, back on the books, everything back on the balance sheets, you know, and back in the earnings, and you can't just kind of keep on manipulating these out of your, you know, special interest deals out of the equation. That's what happened with CIT Group. They put it in the footnotes and kind of hid the whole thing. If you would have seen that back in, I think, November, December, you would have not known what was going on with CIT.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. I think the banks have become so opaque in terms of their accounting, and the rules are now changing at the, you know, but the rule this morning is not going to be the rule this afternoon. So it becomes impossible to actually compare and look at this in terms of a normal P&L analysis to say, look, overall, is the bank making money? Is it a good proposition or not? It becomes impossible. And what they're now doing is moving these so quickly, you just don't get a very, very comfortable feeling.
Yeah.
But for the moment, the financial markets seem to be ignoring all of that. I always joke that facts don't matter until they do.
Right.
And I think it might be, well, a case of catching up
right.
at some stage in time when they realize you've got to come back to the core franchises, and the core franchises are damaged. Well, and the core franchises yep. will take years to remedy.
Let me throw this last point out. I think that you'll agree with me. If the Fed of the United States of America is denying or holding back a Supreme Court order to release the information about the banks that they loaned money to, and they are not doing it. They are fighting it tooth and nail. They're fighting lawsuit by Bloomberg tooth and nail, and they're saying they're not going to disclose the information. Why should any of the banks feel they have to disclose any information to anybody else? The moral risk is starting from the top, from the bailouts, and from the fact that, you know, we're basically making rules as we want to as we go along. What do you think about that rant?
I think it's absolutely correct. I just joke now, most Western developed countries are very similar to Chinese socialism, but with Western characteristics.
Yeah.
And I remember when the Soviet Union used to be around, you remember their newspaper was called Pravda, Truth. And the one thing you knew was there was no truth in it. And essentially, that's what you're actually finding. Because I found this whole thing with the Fed refusing to disclose, saying that it would damage the banks, to be extraordinary. It's, after all, taxpayers' money they're talking about.
Yeah, there's got to be something in there, you know. First of all, we know the Citibank absorbed a massive amount. We know the Bank of America absorbed a massive amount. We know that Wells did, and this one did, and that one did. It's got to be one of the big boys they gave much more money to. You know, don't forget, Goldman says they didn't need money. They had to take it. We all know they were about to go down. Every, you know, there's a run on all these companies.
Absolutely. They would all be have been
right.
affected to
exactly,
a certain degree.
Exactly. Last question. Eastern Europe, do we have still a big problem there?
I think Eastern Europe is a problem, but you've got to take that into context. The Eastern European economies are relatively small in the global scheme of
yeah.
things,
yeah.
leaving
yeah.
Russia out of it.
Yeah.
The second thing is the IMF, as you know, has raised a lot of money.
Tremendous.
They've got a $500 billion fund.
Mm-hmm.
So they have reduced what I would call the tail risk
mm-hmm.
in Eastern Europe. It's not over. What I think is going to be more problematic out of Eastern Europe is most of the lending in Eastern Europe was done by Western European banks. So the Austrian banks, the Scandinavian banks, some of the German banks have significant exposure to Eastern Europe. And I think that's where the problem will come, because they will take substantial write-offs. So Eastern Europe overall, I don't think, is in healthy shape, but it's the risk has reduced somewhat over the last 6 to 12 months,
yeah.
simply because they have been proactive and these mechanisms for supporting them have been put in place. Also geopolitically, given the problems with Russia, Western Europe has a vested interest in keeping particularly the Eurozone members in Eastern Europe stable. So the German Hausfrau will have to yet again bail out another part of Europe.
Mm. I got to tell you something. A year ago, two years ago, when we heard that a bank would require $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion, they're going to take write-downs, we all gasped and were horrified, if you recall.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now a $10 billion write-down is not even a big deal.
Well, I think, as I'm fond of saying, a trillion ain't what it used to be.
A trillion ain't what? What's after a trillion?
I'm sorry?
What's after a trillion?
Oh, I think it's a quadrillion.
Quadrillion, nice.
I actually can send you a check. I have a check from Zimbabwe, which is for $1 quadrillion to buy a motor car in Harare.
Yep.
And I hope to hell that that's not where we end up.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I want to thank you very much, Das, for joining us and for enlightening us about the banks. And I'm going to do my best to put some information about you on our site, some links to the information that you provide. You're very knowledgeable. And one day, maybe I'll take that long schlep to get to the Down Under and spend some time with you, and we'll share some time together in the Outback.
It would be terrific. I look forward to it. Thank you for asking me.
You know, Das, one of the things I want to mention before we go is that you have a book out. Tell me about it.
Well, the book came out in 2006. It's called Traders, Guns, and Money, Knowns and Unknowns in the Dazzling World of Derivative. And curiously, it anticipated some of the problems in derivatives markets and the broader problems that leverage that it was creating actually had on the system overall. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of good timing in that way.
Very good time. You know what? I think that that we're going to do is make sure that we have a link on the show notes, and we'll put that right. I guess it's available at Amazon, et cetera. And we'll put a link right there. And I think that is something probably that a lot of listeners are going to want to check out, because, you know, the information that's out there right now is a lot of looking backwards. But this kind of was a little bit looking forward to some of the things that were going to happen. And derivatives in particular have become obviously a nasty, nasty brew. So we'll get that out. Say the name of the book again.
Traders, Guns, and Money, Knowns and Unknowns in the Dazzling World of Derivatives.
Terrific. We'll get it out there, and we'll make sure that everybody out there pick up a copy. I think you'll enjoy it very much. Das, thanks for your time again, and thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
I appreciate you asking me, Andrew.
Okay,
bye-bye.
And that's what we call a wrap. That Das is such a great guy. I really enjoy speaking with him. He's so smart. Man, that guy is, I mean, really smart. And knows his stuff, been in the trenches, he understands it. He built some of it, you know, and as he said, back in the days with Merrill. Anyway, so we'll be here next week, of course, and make sure you listen to DH Unplugged, my podcast with John Dvorak, that we had some interesting things to discuss this week. You can find those at dhunplugged.com, and also we have links on the Disciplined Investor. I'm going to put that link for that guaranteed income flow on the Disciplined Investor site too. The show notes. Just go to the show notes section of the Disciplined Investor. Just click on that, and the show notes for this show will come up. And there'll be a little form that I guess we could send you information, a little PowerPoint presentation that kind of explains some of this. I think it's pretty cool. But you know, if you're looking for income, that is, and you're looking for guarantees, not everybody is. And we'll do that, and then when we get back next week, we're going to have some cool things to talk about. Of course, if you want to contact me at any time, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Add me to Twitter or Facebook. That's also on the site. You can kind of click that. But Twitter is Andrew Horowitz, and then you'll be the first to get the instant alert when the podcasts are up, etc. Until next time, have a very good week, a profitable week, and we'll see you real soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.